Ah ja, okay. With the title From Knowledge to Entrepreneurship, Capacity Building in a Changing Internet Environment. And I have to change here a little bit to, yes. My name is Horst Zuse. I'm coming from the Technical University in Berlin, and behalf of Germany, Land of Ideas, I moderate this best practice forum. Originally, it was submitted as a workshop. Germany, Land of Ideas, wants to make a contribution to the debate during the second IGF in Rio de Janeiro with this book here. And if you don't have this book, there are some pieces here. That's a contribution. And okay, Germany, Land of Ideas, a public-private nation branding initiative. It was initiated in 2005 by Germany's political and business communities under the auspices of the federal president, Horst Köhler, and aims to present Germany as a creative and innovative place. And today we have panelists here. And the procedure then is the following. There's one missing because that is Mr. Neil Quaynor. I couldn't change it. This one is right here now. The procedure now is the following. The panelists introduce herself or himself and for 1 minute, that means with a name and with their profession for 1 minute. Then I make an introduction. And after my introduction, each panelist has up around 7 minutes time to talk to the audience. So please, let's start on the right side there. Please introduce with the name and your profession.
My name is Nee Quaynor. I'm a computer scientist, but I'm the convener of AFNOG.
I am Roberto Sackman from the International Labor Office, and I'm an engineer economist.
And left?
I'm Walter Roseman. I'm CEO of a small consulting firm called Compass Rose International, and I chair for the ITU their youth forum and also their working group on private sector issues.
And on the left?
I have no.
I'm Michelle Fernando. I'm from Sri Lanka. I'm an engineer working for a telecom operator in Sri Lanka. And I'm also a Youth Forum fellow from ITU Telecom Asia 2004. And I've continued to work with the youth program ever since.
And there is another panelist, Suhas Kupiniat, from India. And he cannot be with us, so we have to make a video connection to India, and we will do it now and then back to me. Okay, takes us here and then back to me. It's a little bit complicated, but we will handle it.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we already hear you, yeah.
Please, can you present yourself?
Yeah. Hi, my name is Suhas Gopinath, and I'm the CEO and president of Globals Incorporated. I'm from India, and I've been recognized as the youngest CEO of the world. I started a company at the age of 14 years, and now I'm 21 years, and I'm also a student of engineering in India.
Same that after my talk has 7 minutes time as the first speaker. Okay? Good. Now we are going back to here. Yeah, I can see it there. As after my talk is the first speaker.
Okay. You are the first speaker. Okay.
After the chairman's talk.
Okay, so. Sure.
Okay, so now here, and then you can proceed. A little bit complicated.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, maybe that's this as a presentation. Now I give a short presentation on behalf of Land of Ideas in Germany, and then the panelists will talk around 7 minutes, and then we have a discussion of 30 minutes after the talks of the panelists with their ideas. On behalf of the Land of Ideas, I will give an example from an idea to an entrepreneur and entrepreneurship in Germany. And I think this is a very interesting story, and it is the work of Konrad Zuse, of my father, and who had the idea of the first computer worldwide, built the first functioning computer in 1941, and became an entrepreneur with the computer company Zuse KG, and all the risks with hard work, financial problems, and so on, in a very difficult time. And yeah, this is here in 89, this is here in, yes, in 89, and that is 92, and this here, he is 6 years old. This is his father, was a postmaster, and this is his mother, and he went to school. He went to school in the eastern part of Germany, and the mother was a seamstress, and the name of this small city is Hoyerswerda, is still existing in Germany, and there he made his school leaving examination. And at this time in his school books, you can not find anything about computers or calculators, nothing. You can find nothing. What you can find are cartoons. You can find such cartoons. They're 16 years old, and they lived in this building. And there is another cartoon from this time when he was 16 years old. This is mathematics on Monday morning in this school. And this is his shanty, and you really cannot find any idea of that he would build later computers. And he built this cranes there, and then he began his study in Berlin at the Technical High School Charlottenburg from 1929. And he started with machine building, and it was boring for him, and then he changed to architecture, and it was boring for him, and then he went away from the university for half a year, and he went to the US Ford Company in 1932, and he made advertising posters for this company. And still you cannot see any ideas of computer, of calculators, or small table calculators, or anything else. And he made, for example, these cartoons here. And as you know, the conditions at this time in Germany, 32 and 33, were not very good. And here you can see the Ford Company and something like that here. And then he went back to the Technical High School Charlottenburg in Berlin and changed again the direction of his study to a civil engineer, and that changed his life. He had to make a lot of calculations, and there he got the idea to make it easier. Is it possible to make it easier? And this was only an idea at this time. There was no much money at this time. His parents didn't have much money. And he thought about to build machines for the engineers to calculate the very complicated things. And there he had the first ideas with his computers, and I will show you them. And he had the first ideas with computers, this two one I will show. And then he founded a company in Germany, and you will see it in the next 5 minutes. And he came in 1935. He quit his position at the Henschel Aircraft Company and came to his parents and said, I need your living room in Berlin. And it was in Berlin Kreuzberg. I will build a full automatic calculating machine. The name computer was not aware at this time. And he started with metal sheets. And 2 years later, you can see the living room in Berlin-Kreuzberg with the first computer he built, the Z1, in 1938. And you, in this machine, you can find 30,000 metal sheets, the four basic calculations with binary floating point numbers, the Boolean logic, binary memory for 64 numbers, each number 22 bits, and this machine was freely programmable. And here you can see the memory for one bit. This is a zero, and that is the one of the memory. And that was in 1938, and he had a problem with this machine. It didn't work reliable. And so he started in 1939, and this was a private development. The Z1, this first machine, was a private development. So the parents paid, his friends paid, and his sister paid, and another guy of a company in Berlin gave him some money. And then in 39, he started the machine Z3. And there only is existing this painting of this machine, because almost all his machines were destroyed by Allied air raids during the Second World War. And this is a machine, it's a reconstruction of this machine. And on May 12, 1941, he could show this machine to five people from the Henschel Aircraft Company. There was no press, no newspaper, nothing of this was there. It was no sensation at this time. However, today it is accepted that this machine, which you can see here, was full functioning digital computer worldwide at this date, May 12, in 41. And it was the same architecture than his first computer. And here you can see this machine, and you can see almost all the components of a modern computer, like the memory, the multiplexer, input and output devices, a punch tape reader for the instructions and the program, the arithmetic unit, and the clock frequency generator here. And the clock frequency of this machine was 5 hertz, not 5 gigahertz, 5 hertz of this machine. And this was his idea, and on this first machine was destroyed too. And in 1949, he founded a company, and his way went to an entrepreneur, and he founded the first computer company selling computers for commercial applications in this building here. It's in the middle of Germany, in Neukirchen, Kreis Hünfeld, 100 kilometers north of Frankfurt. And in this building, and you can see it still today, he started producing computers in Germany. And there were only two computers at this time in US, the Mark I and the ENIAC. And he started producing computers, and Germany was destroyed up to 70% as a consequence of the Second World War. And the first computer which he did sell to Switzerland, to the university in Zurich, was this big machine with 2,500 phone relays and a memory for 64 numbers. And this machine worked 5 years in Switzerland. It was a great success, and it was in Europe the first commercial sold computer. And this is another very nice machine which he did sell in Germany. It was the company Leitz, producing lens systems for cameras and digital cameras today. And this computer, the Leitz company paid with the order 300,000 marks for this computer. And that was in 55. And so the company at this time had 28 employees. And I show you some more slides. And this machine is a very famous machine computer in Germany. As a Z22, it is a tube machine, as a tube computer. And this is the first computer with tubes produced in series in Germany, first delivered in 58 to the university and scientific institutions, with 48 machines and a price of 180,000 marks. And the question is, where was IBM at this time? They had the IBM 650, but they were too late in Germany with this machine. And this is the production line of this company from 49 to 69, 251 computers with a value of 102 million marks. That was a consequence of his idea in 36, because he had to make so much calculations in the study of civil engineering. And remember, this was the first computer company founded with 3 employees. And in 64, it was this company grow up to 1,200 employees. And then because of financial problems, this company went over into the Siemens company in Germany. However, if you look here at this map of Europe, every red dot is a SUSE computer at this time in Europe and in Germany, coming out from this idea a long time before. And now, I think the last slide, what is saying US to this development in Germany, to this idea in Germany? And there's a small book, 100 Years, Datenverarbeitung means electronical data processing, and this is from IBM from 1990, and if you look at page 65, you can find this picture here, and there you can find the statement in Germany, a civil engineer built the first computer, no restrictions, nothing. And this is the quintessence of his idea. And now we are coming back to Best Practice Forum from Knowledge to Entrepreneurship, Capacity Building in a Changing Environment. And now I would say that the panelist Suhas Kupinat should take up to 7 or 9 minutes about his work, and then we are switching back to the other panelists, and then we have the discussion. And please say him.
Hi everyone. It was very unfortunate. I was not able to fly to Brazil today because of some issues.
Yeah.
It is of course a pleasure.
Okay, turn off it, yeah.
And of course, I started 14 years, and it is in fact a very hard. It was extremely very adventurous for me to be as an entrepreneur, as the other panelists indicated. I've been enjoying as an entrepreneur for the past 7 years. As of now, I'm 21 years of age, and my ambition was to be a veterinarian, and it so happened that. I hail from a middle class family in India, and I was introduced to the world of internet from a mere cyber center. I didn't have a computer at my house, and with this spirit from the cyber center, I was highly motivated by the success path of the Microsoft founder, Mr. Bill Gates. I read one of his articles in one of the cyber center. I was still in my high school when I used to visit the cyber cafe, and I felt that it is where I was ignited to be an entrepreneur, and it is where my entrepreneurial spirit was being ignited. In fact, my monthly pocket money was only 25. Likesha was only 1 euro. Every month, and when I had to surf at a cyber center, I had to pay approximately 4 or 5 euros every hour, and it is where I felt that I didn't have the funds to surf at the cyber center. So I started to work at the cyber center whenever the cyber center used to be shut down for the lunch hours. I went to the cyber cafe owner and I did indicate that I want to work for you. So it is where uh, I started to learn opportunity evaluation. I learned the sense how to approach the people, and I was still 14 years, and it is where I felt that okay, why not I make my own website that can start offering email addresses to others. I was really fascinated by the world of internet, and I felt that I can make my own website. In fact, the first knowledge which I had about the internet was that when I had my first email address, I went back to my school and I started to hand over my username and the passwords to all my friends. So it was the knowledge I had about the internet and email. But it is where with the help of internet, I slowly started to improve my learning, and finally I was able to launch my own website, and finally along with one of my friend in the US and one of my friend in India, we finally incorporated our company in the United States in the state laws of California, because in India when you need to start a company, you need to be 18 years of age. So since I was minor, I was not allowed to start a company in India, and finally we had to incorporate our company in the United States. And slowly, our company was making only websites to other companies. We were offering only the mere web development and web designing services. So it is where we felt that we had an American company called Network Solutions that had agreed to outsource us some of the web development projects from the US. So I had the advantage of me attending my school in the morning, and in the evenings I used to sit in front of this computer and I used to work for this American company. I used to make websites for this company, and of course I had the advantage between India and the United States, because we had approximately 12 hours of time difference between India and the United States, and at the same time we felt that our company's major objective myself and my friends opting for entrepreneurship was one of the major factors to offer employment to others irrespective of their academic qualification, because when I was a freelancer at the age of 14 years, and whenever I went out to sell my services to other companies, all the companies used to laugh at me, that is, yeah, you're only 14 years, and we feel very insecure in outsourcing our services to your company. So it is where I felt that I have to set up enterprise where we never recruit anyone looking at their academic skills, and it is one of the HR policies that we incorporated, which was highly acclaimed by various management institutions. And at the same time, our company also made sure that we also adopt certain marketing strategies. That is, we went to some yellow pages of American companies, and we started to approach those companies in the US which didn't have a website. We started to send them email addresses. Let's say we found some automobile spare parts companies in the US which didn't have a website. And whenever I wanted to sell my services to these companies, all the companies used to say that without even having a website, we still make money. So why do we require a website? So it is where it may sound very unethical, but when I was at the age of 15 or 16, I didn't have much of thinking, and I made few anonymous email addresses. I send them emails. With these anonymous emails, I used to send them, okay, I'm interested in your automobile spare parts. Will you be able to send me your website link so that I can have a look at your automobile spare parts, and if it's impressive, we will import your spare parts. So look at all these American companies which didn't have a website used to reply me, Oh no, we are sorry, Mr. XYZ, we still haven't made a website, but you can find these attachments of our spare parts. So after a week, I used to send an email in my own name as Suhas Gopinath, and I used to ask them, okay, would you be interested in taking our web development services? So it is how we adopted certain marketing strategies in which we increase the number of customers, and at the same time we always made sure that we offer excellent customer support. But I also would like to mention the fact that I hail from one of this non-business family and a middle class family in India, and my father was working for the Indian Air Force as a scientist, and it was like as I was in fact when I opted to be an entrepreneur, everyone in my family considered me to be an odd man out, and it was extremely hard for me to overcome my family issues and academic issues because I was still a student when I started the company. So it was extremely hard because my family was very orthodox and they were not so open minded. At the same time, even my mother used to assume I've started a hobby club with my friends in the US, and she used to feel very insecure, and she used to feel that okay, if they opt for an entrepreneur, he may not be settled in his life. So it was a mindset which my family members had. So I as an entrepreneur from this non-business family, it was something very hard for me, but at the same time it was always very adventurous for me as an entrepreneur because at every step I used to enjoy myself. I used to face some obstacles, I used to face some setbacks, and I had some funny incidents where I was not allowed to sign agreements for a certain project because I was under 18 years. And whenever I had to sign any MOU or whenever I had to sign any agreements for projects, just to say that okay fine, the CEO of this company is still under 18 years, so we wouldn't like to outsource a project to a CEO who cannot who still not has authority to sign on the papers. So so it was extremely very hard at certain stages, but we really had to overcome this. And at the same time, I also had incidents where as I mentioned, I'm still a student of engineering, and I had some funny incidents where my own professors and the lecturers at my university started to apply for employment in my company. So I really had to handle all these issues, and we really enjoyed, and I think entrepreneurship is all about you being adventurous, and you being seeing the obstacles which is around you, and how to overcome the obstacles. But in my case, I had the major setback was my age itself, because even whenever I used to attend any seminars or conferences, I was not allowed inside. The security at the conference hall, at the seminar hall, used to stop me and tell that, okay, fine, students are not allowed inside this conference room. It is only the CEOs or executives who are allowed inside the conference room. So I had to undergo some obstacles as such, and myself and my other co-founders, we really enjoyed as entrepreneurs, because every day is a whole new life for us. We see new obstacles, we see new people, and we've been doing. And at the same time, when our company had to expand as a multinational company, because we started a virtual office in the US, and I was completely operating from a cyber center here in India. And when our company had to grow like a multinational company with offering employment to hundreds of people. When our company had to expand as a multinational company, from a small office, we started to associate with our sales representatives abroad. We never pay them salaries, but we started to pay them commissions, and it is how our company is from a small home office. We expanded as a multinational company with offices in 11 countries, and at the same time, we also started to recruit employees from this non-academic background. We only started to look at their IT skill sets, and it is how we started to expand. So like actually when we look back, we feel that like actually we have sacrificed our student life and teenage life, but the ultimate satisfaction as an entrepreneur, which I enjoy every day, is like which energizes me as an entrepreneur, is the fact that okay, we have offered employment to hundreds of eligible unemployed youth all over the world, and like actually I think we will be able to do this like actually in the future as well. Thank you.
Mr. Copinha, thank you very much for your statements. And now we have the next panelist here, Walda Roseman, on the left from US. And please make your statements and contributions.
Yes, thank you very much.
I don't need it again. No. You can leave it there.
Okay. Thank you very much. I did not bring a PowerPoint presentation. It's easier to contract what I have to say. I want to just put a few things out first, and that is, what are we talking about when we're talking about an entrepreneur? I'm not about to give a dictionary definition. What I define as an entrepreneur comes from personal experience and from the experience of the people in the companies I deal with. First of all, being an entrepreneur is not for everyone. It means that you have to have a high threshold for risk-taking. You need a clear vision of market or social need. You need focus on that vision, self-confidence that you can turn it into a business or an initiative. You have to work hard and be prepared for setbacks. And you need skills and determination to follow it through. In many ways, by the way, this describes young people. I would just, as an aside, note that like the previous two speakers, I come from a long line of entrepreneurs and, in fact, inventors. I'm an entrepreneur, but my grandfather actually invented the vending machine. He invented the many of the early prefabrication approaches to constructing houses, and he invented the first assembly line barrel maker. As a businessman, he was an absolute disaster. Every single one of those businesses failed. I live on what I earn, not on royalties. And so what it shows is that having a brilliant idea, being a brilliant technician, being able to build something is not sufficient enough to be a successful entrepreneur, sadly. What are we talking about here? Well, we're actually talking about, if you connect an entrepreneur to the next step, you're talking about an enterprise. And I'd like to talk about two different kinds of enterprises. They have something in common, and that is that they're sustainable. Whether they're sustainable because they raise financial dividends, they have financial dividends, or they're sustainable because they can support themselves over time in order to have social dividends. These are both enterprises, whether they're for-profit or they're not-for-profit. And when we're talking about young people, when we're talking about developing countries, in particular, where enterprise, particularly small and medium-sized enterprise, can be the engine of social and economic development, then I think it's important to keep in mind that we are not necessarily talking about building something that is going to be large and make millions or billions of money. It's fine if it does, but that's not necessarily what we have here. I was really happy to be invited to be on this session because I think that as we're looking at internet issues going forward, it's very important that we focus more on the issue of where we're going to get our talent around the world, where we're going to find our innovation, where we're going to find those who not only create a value for the ICT industry and the media industry, but who use it to create value. And here we have a group of somewhat marginalized entities and people who can become the next engines for our society, and particularly developing society. And yet one hears very little about that here. In fact, my personal view is I'd like to see much more focus on capacity building, much more focus on development of small and medium-sized enterprises at future IGFs. Okay, with that background then, let me very quickly just talk about not the kinds of capacity building that are happening in the ICT industry, but what the priorities are. And here I'm talking about the industry at large, where I chair the ITU's working group on private sector issues. It's in the development sector of the ITU. We have regional working parties. We have many, many, many companies that are coming from the regions who are setting what their priorities are. And a high priority, if not the highest, is capacity building. But within that priority, the highest priority is capacity building for regulators. They put capacity building for companies immediately after that. But the first concern is, if the governments don't understand how businesses work, what businesses need, what we need as entrepreneurs, how markets fit into what their public policy objectives are, then we're not going to have much of a chance of succeeding here in the marketplace. So I wanted to throw that out there before we got into the actual priorities for capacity building for entrepreneurs themselves. In terms of the industry that already exists and the companies that I deal with, both in my business and through this working group, the biggest issues are about transition of networks to IP networks, understanding how the internet works, and transition to an infrastructure that is going to support that, both on mobile and fixed platforms. Also of critical interest to them are the skills it takes to compete. Now, many of these are companies that we used to call the PTTs, who may have changed their name, certainly have changed the market certainly has changed around them, but what that means is that their skill base and their personnel base has to change, also for new entrants. And this is a complex a process, and one that I think is not nearly happening enough in the marketplace. Now, I want to switch very quickly now to the issue of young people. I've also have the honor of chairing the ITU's Youth Forum. And the Youth Forum now has 1,100 alumni from 191 countries. They started as active university leaders, and we have a woman and man from every country. They have developed their own entrepreneurial networks, whether they're social or commercial. And what this program has done is it has created a network which creates networks of young entrepreneurs. Now, I want to very quickly list what we found are the best practices and just the elements of the best practices, and then focus on a few points that are missing. Best practices in terms of bringing youth into the entrepreneurial world or into the business world include individual and group empowerment, information about ICT and opportunities, mentoring, which is both professional mentoring, such as business, technology, development leaders, and peer-to-peer. And in fact, this network exists in something called Human Network, which is the Youth Forum alumni, where young people work with each other to support their own entrepreneurial activities and to create partnerships. It requires helping young people create a vision and an action plan, in turning individual and group ideas into business concept proposals, and then teaching them how to develop those into business plans, strategic communication skills, proposal writing. Now, I know I'm running out of time, but I want to just plate a few ideas of what's missing. There are some very critical things that are still missing. One is mentoring and assistance in how to build a business where to find and how to pay for additional education and training, how to work with governments, where to find and forge partnerships, industry visibility of youth-inspired innovations, programs, and businesses, and perhaps the most important, access to financial resources. We don't train people to become entrepreneurs to set them up for failure, and yet it is very difficult for young people, for women, for SMEs, to get the kind of funding that they need in order to carry through with what may be the best and most bankable business plans. And I will end there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next panelist is Michelle Fernando from Sri Lanka, please.
Hello, I'm from Sri Lanka, and I'm a product of this ITU Telecom Youth Forums. I was the co-chairwoman for ITU Telecom Asia 2004, and ever since then I've been working with ITU Youth Program, and I would take this opportunity to really thank Ms. Walda, who is the creator, the chairman of the steering committee for all ITU Youth Forum events. As Walda mentioned, the ITU Telecom Youth Forums are organized by ITUD, and it brings up a lot of youth from the region for the regional events and from the whole globe for the world event, who are coming from engineering, policy making, and business backgrounds. So it is really an advantage for all the youth who get in, who are just finishing up their studies or graduate studies, or who are just starting their graduate studies, to find a place to meet and share ideas, and of course mentoring from industrial leaders, policymakers, leaders in policymaking, because the youth forum brings up all those people together and give the youth a chance. Sometimes those youth who attend the forum, it is their first time out of their own countries, so it is really a life-changing experience for them. And in the site I have just put up, if you go and see, there are a lot of ideas shared by the youth who have attended, and you can find more information in the official site as well. We are in the Young Leaders in ICT website, which is also a part of the human network. Most of the human networkers, and we are all giving our posts in this site, and there are a lot of ongoing projects, online work, online courses where everybody is exchanging their ideas and views like that. So this is it's the background of the youth forum, and I would like to introduce three young entrepreneurs who are products of this youth forum. If I may start, I will start with Kafui. He's from Ghana. He's a young entrepreneur, social entrepreneur. He's working in Ghana in a lot of development activities in the ICT technology. And this, if you can get more details of Kafui in his own website. So these are young people who have attended with a vision, who have gone back to their countries and done a work, and who is gaining recognition in their region as young leaders. And another person would be Benga Sisan. He's also a social entrepreneur and an information society researcher, and he has been given a lot of recognition from Nigeria. He has proven that if you have an idea, you can go and even influence the government in order to take up on your ideas. And he's also a part of the youth forum, and he's from the first ever youth forum, which was held in 2002, if I'm correct, 2001. And of course, we have another young, like from the last youth forum, which was held in 2006 in Hong Kong, we had Patrick Crossgave, who initiated this Rock the Vote campaign. He is the CEO of Rock the Vote Ireland. He's carrying out actually volunteering work and lot of youth-led activities and use of modern media for effective communications in Ireland, and he's having a lot of business in the United States as well. So these were young people who got together, who had a vision, and they had a chance to expand because they had their own ideas to go ahead. These were three very successful stories. But there are a lot of other youth who attended these forums. When going back home, they had the ideas, but when it came to financial assistance, their ideas did not get flourished like these three people. One could be, if I name it, Solmnaf, who's from Mongolia. She's running her own ICT workshop classes, but she's held back because she cannot get financial assistance from her country or the government or the bankers because she does not have a record or she does not have a history of entrepreneurship behind her. So these are people who have good ideas because she's doing well in her own country from her own capacity, but indeed she needs more help. And another person would be Leonardo from Ecuador, who actually had one obstacle, that is, we had to find some computers to do his own ICT workshop in Ecuador. But what he went was, he was a bit, he took the challenge a bit, and he went to a local net cafe and told them that that person was paying a huge amount of money for the rent. And what this guy gave the business proposal to the net cafe was, you can run your business from my home. I will give you the first floor of my home. You can run the net cafe, but in the non-business hours, I must be able to use your computers to teach the local kids. So those two, and he is now working on it. So it is, for him also, it was the financial barrier, which was financial support was the barrier. So it is really important, and it was also mentioned in the recently held youth forum in Geneva, ICT Youth and ICT for Development Forum, which was held in Geneva last month by GAID and ITU in joint, that there should be a place for youth entrepreneurs to go to, a place where they can have support, where they can be taken seriously, where they will be getting financial support to carry out their bankable ideas. It could be for profit or for non-profit, but there should be one place, and this is what we are lacking. There are a lot of organizations scattered around, but it is, as for youth from developing countries especially, it is hard to find a place to reach out. So it is high time that we find such organization, or it's high time we take opportunity to create such an bondage or foundation for young entrepreneurs in the future. And I would like to quote from the last ITU Telecom Youth Forum 2006 declaration, where these were the words of the youth who were gathered there. There were 265 students, youth from the world. What they said as one of the actions were, we, the youth fellows of the ITU Telecom World 2006, recognize that we can wait for change or we can initiate change. We can commit to initiating change. We will start with reasonable actions that can be implemented in our home countries and regions in partnership with the ITU, governments, universities, companies, and other bodies. We commit ourselves to the following actions, and we hope you will follow. So I hope there will be people who will be willing to follow up and help the youth in the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So now we have the next panelist. This is Neil Quenor from Ghana on the right here.
Thank you very much, Chairman. I think I'll first try some entrepreneurial activity on you, and thereafter I will suggest some approaches to developing entrepreneurship from knowledge, and I might close with some one or two examples which you might find interesting. I'm going to talk about a computer. is not Zeus. It's older than Zeus. It has no clocks. It has no microsequencer. It has no multiplexers. It has no decoders. Because it's a mechanical computer. And there is such a computer that has been associated with Africa for a very long time. Today's remnants is in the form of a game which has two roles, typically, and we play all sorts of games with different rules on it. As it turns out, it's really a very effective calculator, mechanical, and that's why it doesn't have anything like multiplexer, because it's the human operator who is doing it. But I can add up two numbers. One row is one number, next row is another number, and I add it like this. The result is in the second row. If you give me two boards, I'll be able to do multiplication and division, because you know it's the same. Okay, so that's an idea. Now, this is now marketing for a new book which has just come out. And I hope you see entrepreneurship. Okay, take the idea and somehow gel it and find a way for you to hear about it in, let's say, a pleasant way. Then you can buy it, I can print more books, and life goes on. Now, some approaches that we've found effective in helping young people move from an idea all the way to getting products on the market include the following. There are business development institutions that you can actually put in place to help young people understand what it means to have a business plan, what it means to actually go through a good governance process without messing up your business with your own personal interests, all the way to how to position products on market and so on. So those kinds of institutions, in my opinion, may indeed be very effective advisory activity that we might consider. I've also found very useful business linkages. In other words, quite often, a forum like this is a very healthy way because businesses can find themselves and establish some form of linkages. And it's something that we think is also a good thing to do, especially for the youth. Financing was mentioned as a challenge. But sometimes you can do innovative financing in the sense that it doesn't have to be one-on-one kind of thing. I mean, I should be able to take a group of small businesses and go co-subordinate funding for all of them, meaning we'll market them together, thereby reducing the costs for each of them in looking for the funding. So there are some ideas in those areas that we can tap on. Now, more recently, business process outsourcing is coming out as a major thing, but the point here is that you have to do results-based export related kind of things. In a sense that you can't just go addressing the whole area. So if someone decides that he wants to work in, let's say, in next generation web activities, then you must target, you know, the help you give the person such that he is able to penetrate that particular market. That means you have to do some strategic training, particular specialized training for the person, and so on and so forth. Another thing that we found very useful is sort of a clustering kind of idea, meaning that if there's a big telco, he can do a lot by having smaller SMEs around, you know, the telco who provide various services for them. In so doing, the telco may save costs, but it also opens opportunity for the telco to have access to innovation because it will come from a very wide variety of areas, and that's another. So it's sort of like incubation or association or that kind of thing, which we've also found very useful. With respect to me, I have been very fortunate in a number of entrepreneurial activities. I started the first computer science department at University of Cape Coast. I don't know whether that's non-profit, but it's academic, and the department is still there. And even though I've gone away and come back teaching there, I teach for my former student who is the head of department. So as an entrepreneur, these things of rank and so on don't mean anything. What you want is action, okay? You want to be able to have effect. And that's the case of the University of Cape Coast Computer Science Department. I also started a company called Network Computer Systems in 88. It was an equipment supplier because I used to work for Digital Equipment Corporation. And of course, we gradually grew the time with the changes, became an integrator, and eventually that was the first ISP in West Africa. So I didn't know in the beginning I'll go from an equipment support, you know, maintenance group to become, you know, an ISP. But you can't be static. This is a very fast-changing industry. So you, as you hone in your skills, you should move the wave, so to speak. And that's a very useful example. Another one that might be of interest in the nonprofit area is some of the work that Mohammed and myself have been doing in gathering the African technical community to begin to address certain issues. And this example is AFNOG. And AFNOG is a very lightweight organization in terms of administration. It's really just 2-3 persons, even if that, they are all volunteering. And then a whole host of instructors who are, you know, ex-graduates of the workshop. So there's like 100 of them, and we've trained over 600 folks within the last decade or so. So you can see how a very lightweight organization that engages other people can also have such huge impact. A majority of the network operators of significance on the continent have been trained through this program, as an example. Sure, no problem. I'm actually on my concluding remark. Don't speak too much. So you've seen some few examples. That's a capacity building institution, and most of the people we are training are young, so I can see some relevance here. I think, in conclusion, Africa really needs to have more entrepreneurs. We normally do a fair amount of that activity at a commercial level in commerce. On the other hand, we need to move into slightly different areas, in particular in the, you know, networking area, and do the very best we can. And so we have a program of constantly, you know, looking for young people and helping them. I myself have been, I don't know what you call, an angel for a number of companies in Ghana. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So the next and last panelist is Roberto Zachmann from Intergovernmental Organization. Please start.
Good afternoon. I'm personally not an entrepreneur, I'm a bureaucrat. So I won't be able to talk to you about businesses or how to make them, but I'll be able to talk about policy. That's the only thing that bureaucrats know how to do. So you take it as you want, but that's more or less the rules of the game. I'll start with the good news. The good news, I think, is that the internet is an absolutely formidable development and growth tool. I'll now go to the bad news. And the bad news is that the internet is a formidable tool to create inequality. And why would I be talking about the inequality, which is going to be the thrust of my conference here? It's because the internet and ICTs leverage knowledge. If you know how to read and write and you know how to do numbers, you're going to be able to use a computer, understand the value of internet. That is going to increase your productivity, and up you go. But a large proportion of the population do not know how to read or write. They do not have the foggiest idea what a computer would do for them economically. They might be able to use it for email, but in order to understand accounting and marketing and all those things that are value-creating, they don't have the foggiest idea. So, in fact, what we are dealing today is with an instrument that is generating inequality. And the policy challenge that we have to adopt is, how are we going to stop this inequality? And here again, the issue is a question of knowledge. And so permit me to describe very quickly the logic that I would like to follow. First, I'll try and explain the general environment. I will then talk about something that I think is crucial and we talk too little about, and that's innovation. Then I'm going to talk about learning enterprises, because the enterprises that innovate are learning enterprises. And I will stop by talking about what conditions have to be adopted by learning enterprises to be able be innovative. I must say that I come from the ILO, so my interest is good enterprises, because good enterprises create good employment.
So, let us start with the general overview, and I'll try and be quick. You will understand that I cannot be gray, I'll have to be black or white, but that's for the case of brevity. The internet has created a very competitive environment. It has helped globalization, as globalization has helped the diffusion of technologies. This implies that you have greater competition and that you have very rapid changes in product life cycles. Anything that is produced today is going to be old-fashioned tomorrow, and therefore enterprises are permanently in process of change and in process of innovation. Enterprises that do not innovate will disappear. Moreover, what is happening is that economies are becoming transversal. You are having supply chains. These supply chains impose on those in the supply chains standardization, the use of technologies, and therefore enterprises in the South that do not have the competencies required to enter supply chains will be excluded. Again, a question of inequality. So the issue fundamentally in terms of policy is what are we going to do to help enterprises in the South? And not all enterprises. Many enterprises in the South are capable of surviving by themselves, but small and medium-sized enterprises cannot. So the question is a question of innovation. Unfortunately, most of the world considers innovation to be product development. If you do not produce an iPod, if you do not have Google, you are not innovating. Well, it so happens that there's a company in Mexico called Cemex that developed an algorithm to deliver concrete in half an hour and guaranteeing it. Cemex is today the second or third largest cement company in the world. You have a company like Sada that competes with the Chinese because it ensures that the inventories in its shops are changed every 3 weeks instead of every 2 or 3 months. That is also innovation. So you have many different forms of innovation that are accessible to anybody and everybody. We frequently say in my country, Colombia, that if you take a car to a Colombian garage, it's going to be much better service than anywhere else in the world because the people that work in those repair shops have such talent that by hearing the engine, they understand what's going on. They don't have computers or anything. They have the talent. They have the feeling for things. And that has to be exploited. There are no magic bullets for innovation. There are some practices that might help innovation. The first one is not having fear of failure. In the United States, an entrepreneur who doesn't fail at least once has absolutely no experience. In France, an entrepreneur who fails once will never be able to go into the market again. First condition is not being fearful of failure. The second one is freedom. It's freedom to dissent. The third one, academic involvement. The fourth one, managerial commitment. And the fifth one, learning enterprises. Finally, I will deal with learning enterprises. A learning enterprise is one that learns to adapt. It is one that knows how to capture knowledge and how to disseminate knowledge. In order to do that, it has to value its employees. It has to empower their employees to be able to acquire knowledge and to be able to share it. In order to acquire and share knowledge, enterprises have to have skilled workers. And here I will end. The major issue in my mind is that when we're talking about the information society, we talk about lots of things in engineers and software programmers. We don't need all that. We need people in every enterprise who is able to be numerate, who is able to learn to learn, who is able to learn how to solve problems, and who is able to work in teams. That is the new knowledge that does not correspond to what Charlie Chaplin did in modern times, but the worker that we need today. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. So we heard a lot of statements, and now the audience can formulate questions or comments. Please say your name and where you are coming from.
How we need to assist them in order to, you know, to realize their ideas and all the stuff that they could do in order to succeed. But I need help. For example, in countries like Namibia, where you have a population of 1.8 million, and they have a lot of young people that are graduating from universities, for example, and have their good ideas, like we said, and they have, some of them even managed to get some help from wherever they get the help from, and only to set up a business and still to be killed by the business that have been already existing and successful. For example, there are in Windhoek alone, there is probably about 400 IT companies for the young people that have just graduated. And the population of Windhoek is less than 1 million, because the whole country is only 1.8 million. So there was a time when we had a tender. And in the tender, we had young people that just graduated that, you know, bid for the tender. And we had companies that had been in the market for long that also bid for the tender. And then this tender, the company that had been in the market before with good CVs, good resumes, they tendered, for example, to create a website for $10,000. And then young entrepreneurs from the colleges are tendering for $1,000. But they can do exactly or even better than the companies that have been in the market. But because those companies have good CVs, they have got a lot of samples of what they did before, they are always considered. And in this case, we are not assisting our young entrepreneurs, like we are saying, we need to assist them in order to realize their dreams. So, and here you have, on the other hand, the government that says, okay, when you put up a tender, or when you are going to buy something from a shop, get 3 quotations, or get 3 people from the tender, and with the idea that at the end of the day, get the cheapest. Now, you choose the cheapest because that's what the tender says. You submit the tender, at the end of the day, they say, okay, this is cheap, but where is the CV of this person? Of course, we understand it's cheap, but how do we know if this person is going to do a quality job for us? Still, at the end of the day, the young entrepreneurs do not benefit, and their companies die out. So I just want to find out if anybody can help me, how do we handle these kind of things? And that many people are, you know, having their ideas, and, you know, you have a lot of people doing the same business. At the end of the day, they are competing with each other, and, I mean, they just don't flourish.
Maybe we can interrupt, because here's a statement.
Okay.
From Maya Roseman.
I think those are all really good and valid questions. First thing, I think a young entrepreneur is as young as an entrepreneur wants to be. To be part of the youth forum, and you compete for that, you need to be in at least your second year of university and be no older than 23. Now, the reason for that is that we're looking for young leaders who can go back to their countries and create networks and businesses and a focus on youth-initiated activities. Now, for your question about the tenders, it's a very good question. It's not unlike the same response that you would get from banks, in that bureaucracies and people who deal with money tend to be risk-averse. and therefore they want proof that you can deliver. Now that's a problem when you are young and you're starting out, or whether you're a woman or you don't have a background or a credit rating. In my view, it requires, I think, a deliberate effort, maybe on the part of the young people, to bring to the attention to the governments that they would benefit, society would benefit by a deliberate policy that gives a leg up to young entrepreneurs. Now, we don't have time to talk about what all of those are, but unless there are those deliberate policies on the parts of government, then I think it's going to be, and on the parts of institutions, it's going to be very difficult to make things happen fast.
Yep. Thank you. Here's another statement. Yeah.
Probably you have defined the problem very well. You enter into a market that appears to be fairly saturated. And there lies the problem. I think that, contrary to others, I believe that if you want to create a business, you have to have a business model that understands who your competitors are, and that the only sort of advice or mentoring or support that you have to get is that support required for sustaining a valid business plan. And I think that it is really important for an entrepreneur to understand that markets are cruel and that you have to come in fighting for whatever you want, and that you do not have to work from the basis of assistance but from your own qualities and your own competitive advantages. So the idea of competing in a market where you're going to have 300 or 400 web designers or telecenters is something that, in terms of a business plan, is not going to work. And I think, and that is one of the things that I think everybody must realize, that business world is a totally Darwinian market. Only the best survive.
Mr. Quino?
I don't have too much to add except to recommend that look elsewhere, okay? I mean, government is not the only source of business. So if you have to establish the prerequisites, be pragmatic, do your business with smaller SMEs, so that by the time the big companies wake up, you've collected all the SMEs. And the SMEs will get bigger. So you eventually will become the biggest. These guys will have no market. Okay, so with every situation that looks like it's bad, actually, if you are a businessman, you turn it into some jewel.
I just wanted to say I think we're all right, because there's an element to all of that. But I wanted to add, go back to the government policy and give you an example from the United States. The U.S. is generally pointed to as the pinnacle, the example of how you can become an entrepreneur. In the United States, more than 50% of all businesses are started by women. Now, one reason is because they hit a glass ceiling, but they have the skills. But 10% of all investment capital from the banks goes into women businesses. Okay. There was a bank called Fleet Bank who a few years ago figured out that there's something wrong here, and so they created a special program where they would fund female entrepreneurs. They have made a lot of money from that, but it wasn't until there was some building of consciousness that there was an inequity in the market and they were losing out on talent and innovation that things changed, and that's the point that I wanted to add.
There's another question. Please say your name and the country you're
My name is Vladimir from Arriba, Brazil, a small company. But I'm also a professor, and we have developed the open business model contradicting in a certain manner the idea that we need war instead of peace, competition in Darwinist vision instead of worldwide collaboration. So there are many schools about how to modeling the world, how to modeling business. I would like to mention 7 principles that we are adopting in our entrepreneurship in Brazil. The first one vision that we translated by dream. Everyone has a dream in mind, especially the young people in probably your country also. The second one is friendship, that we translated in technological terms in terms of collaboration systems. Internet is a collaboration system, and we need to take advantage of that in terms of make business. Peace. There is a tradition in the business schools to say that the wars were the main motivation to create all the innovation in the world, and that's not so true. The fourth, utopia. Utopia? Utopia, right? Mm-hmm. Between the dream and the reality, we need to plan. So, also, ethics, that we could translate in terms of business partners, contractors, well-established in ethical terms, so that you can have credibility. You need to believe in the other partner to make business in a globalized world. Freedom. We are now here discussing an aesthetics of control of internet or aesthetics of freedom of internet, maybe a mix between the two. There are some studies showing that in many companies, the productivity is much better when people have freedom to create, right? Creativity is related with innovation. We are trying to use that in Brazil. There is a demand to a space of young people to create. And also, courage. We need to face the problems. And finally, love. You need to put passion to have a chance.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there a statement by the panelists to this statements? You? Yeah? No, not really,
but I think I like the piece. The important thing I got here is really collaboration, partnering can make a big difference in improving your own credibility and your knowledge and your confidence even in attacking markets. So I think that is something that is very welcome.
Okay, please.
Thank you very much. And I really want to thank all the panelists for the different input.
A little bit. Microphone, yeah.
Okay. So I just start by thanking all the panelists for sharing their views and their experience for that very critical and important topic that is the entrepreneurship and the young people. Because coming back to the environment where I come from, where the challenge is how we're going to make the young people find their way in order to do something. Immigration is one of the worst things that happened to our nation because young people represent more than 50% of our generation. So it means they represent the resources of the humanity and they are finding out their way into that very difficult environment. But in Senegal, I'm going to take the example of Senegal just to phrase my question because I want to share with you one thing is we have started thinking through what we call a strategic economic plan. What's going to be the pillar for our economy that's going to support, for example, the development of the Senegal and Africa in the next coming years? Because we all have that question, how we're going to liaise the economy and the development and how we're going to try to tackle that problem. And we find out that there was five pillars in our sector, five pillars in the economy. One is the agriculture. The second one is the all about seafood and resources from the sea. The third one is the textile industry, all about the cotton and all these things. And the fourth one was tourism. The fifth was ICT and telecom. And I can tell you, based on all the research I have seen from World Bank and all the others, from all these five pillars, there was only one working well, getting a two-letter ratio, that is ICT and telecom. It means if we look at the development for the next coming 10 years in Africa, many countries rely on ICT to create, to be the first job creation in Africa. And the business model that we have previously in that industry was totally different. What he tried to mention is, can he as an entrepreneur, one individual self-made man without any resources, get out from the university, can set up his new company, doing job, and there is no, I mean, we don't care about competition because the potential is 100%. When you have only 2% of connectivity somewhere, the potential is 9,800. It's not, so people don't care about competition because the offer is not there. The demand is there. So what is the new model you can propose to young entrepreneurs that are not well-structured, but individuals, because micro-entrepreneurs represent more than 80% of the company in Africa, in developing world. So a man who finished his studies, got nothing in his pocket, want to start his business, only have his mind and the skills he tried to develop. What is a new business model that we can help him develop with all the young entrepreneurs they get around to see a new model in order to tackle these things? Thank you.
The World Bank, the economic office for the World Bank for Latin America, did a study that compared the wood industry in Sweden and the wood industry in Brazil, and the mining industry in Sweden and the mining industry in Australia. And their question was simple. Why was it that Sweden and Australia, with relatively less dense resources than Sweden and Australia, why was it that Sweden and Australia were much more successful? And their, very quickly, their answer was that they learned to collaborate, that the universities graduated students that were able to work on geology or engineering and logistics, on a number of issues concerning mining, that in Sweden you had universities that researched derived products, that had schools for silviculture. You had a whole issue. Then workers were being returned permanently, retrained, so that the evolution of industry would move workers without fear of losing their jobs, and the industry would progress because everybody was cooperating towards a common goal. So the issue is not whether you're going to be in fisheries or whether you're going to be in mining or whether you're going to be anywhere. It is what is called social capital. It is the idea that a society has to learn to cooperate, to be able to understand the common benefit for all, and to set all the resources required so that these benefits can be achieved. This happens when, for example, you try and organize local economic development, or where you try to organize business clusters. But this is a much more general approach to trying to do an industry-wide sector. I'll guarantee you, if every country in Africa is going to do IT, everybody in Africa is going to die of hunger, because there are other countries that are much more equipped than Africa to do IT. You cannot expect the same sort of strategy anywhere. So I think one of the solutions, as I can say, is social capital. Thank you.
There's another statement.
Yeah, I agree with part of your statement. I think that there's a real value to collaboration. I think that there's plenty of room in Africa for a lot of IT entrepreneurs and businesses. I think that there is not a lack of human talent. And in Africa, in my experience, there is a very strong entrepreneurial and verbal tradition in every country at the grassroots level. I also think that going back to young people are natural innovators, and that we would make a mistake, and in fact this is the philosophy of the ITU Youth Forum. We do not impose business models. We do not try to come up with innovative business models. We don't have to. If we offer the basket of skills and an opportunity to create networks of people and a mentoring that continues beyond that particular forum, then what we find is that the young people come up with much more innovative and better business models than us old folks can. And so the notion that I would suggest is that we all look at how we can create safe places to innovate, to incubate innovation by young people, by women, that we provide the tools, we make it easy to access those tools, we provide the skill base, we do it on a collaborative basis, nationally and regionally and internationally. We make it a priority, and I think that if we can do that, we will not in a few years be sitting here saying what are the business models that we can be showing the young people, but we will have the young people up here saying, here are the business models that you guys may want to consider.
Yep.
I think we should be very clear. India produces many more engineers, many more mathematicians, many more physicists, many more entomologists, many more professionals than the whole of Africa put together. Those engineers are the ones that do high value-added jobs. You can't code. And the more people that enter into the code or who do pages, the less the value of the work they're going to do. The market is not neutral. You cannot compete if you do not have the talent, the skills, and the knowledge. And you have other ways of competing, not trying to compete with countries that are assuming a high value added strategy. I think that that's...
I must respond, Alaji. Listen, I got my PhD in computer science probably before most of the Indians got theirs. Okay? The talent is there. I still write code. I don't know many of them at my age who still write code. Okay? I am writing PKI code. So it's not that the skills are not there or the talent is not there. We just don't have the critical mass. And so what we want is to be able to create multiple copies of Alaji, myself, and so on and so forth, so that it gets to a point that it begins to, you know, sort of avalanche. I think that is where we're trying to go. I can tell you that he is right, because in about 5-6 years, most of the expertise in IPv6 will be found in Africa. Yeah, but, I mean, that's still in the same net area. And the only reason is that they are just fresh building their network. So they're not going to use an earlier standard. They're going to use a new standard. So the moment they start moving and they've trained all these people, we shall be maintaining India's network. Are you following me? The same way that now we do business outsourcing to India, I'm saying that tomorrow it will be outsourced to his boys, who will be sitting in Africa but managing the networks all over the world, simply because they've made a strategic move. I hope you understand. The opportunities come. And if you grab it, you can turn it into jewel. And so, don't be afraid.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I fully understand the strategy approach is trying to... I have been reading all the different things about the competitive advantage of nation, all this stuff. But look, what we're talking about here is that because Indian is very good that US or European are no longer working on the software development? No. I mean, what we're facing in Africa, I don't know if you look at the economics and the dynamics in the economics in Africa. I talk about many sectors who are vital in Africa, but these sectors are dying because of what you call the international and the competitive advantage of nation. Can you tell me any country who can fight against China on the textile industry? No one.
Okay.
Do you think that there is any disadvantage that African people can have by on an equal foot starting to bid and have a long-term strategy on how they're going to serve themselves, and not only for outside, I mean, for themselves, for the local industry. I mean, this guy have to develop website for the entrepreneurs or the people who run his business at the corner. Are he going to ask to the Indian guy to develop the website for him? He have to develop this industry for the local usage and local application in Africa first. And when they start competing at the equal foot with other industry, Indian and Chinese and European and US, so they can compete at the international market. And delocalization is not a vain word, it's reality. So we need to help them because they don't have banks who follow them. Banks are not helping young people in our environment to set up their business. We need to help them think about how they can, go around the banking system and start their new business. If they don't have that answer, they will never start.
Okay, thank you very much. We are running out of time. I don't know whether the next one want to come in this room here. Is there another last question? No? Or is there a statement? Yeah. Okay, then the statement there. Please say him. No voice?
Yeah, hello? Yeah. The first question I wanted to ask is, as we all spoke about entrepreneurship and Takeshi, as I understand that we see that there's lots of entrepreneurs in the developed countries and in the underdeveloped and the developing countries, we have very less entrepreneurs. And according to me, I think more and more entrepreneurs are extremely very much required in these developing countries. So the fact that one of the major setback for a developing country like India or China or other countries is that entrepreneurship or the unemployment itself is one of the major setback in these developing countries. So, I would like to have an opinion from the other speakers about why is that entrepreneurship is mostly encouraged in these Western countries, the developed countries, and why is that the mindset of the individuals is to be employees and is not to be an employer in these developing countries where entrepreneurship is very much required. Thank you
very much. Okay, so we are really running out of time, so I thank you for your contributions, the panelists for your statements, and I close the session. Thank you again.